Believe it or not, I was not officially diagnosed with bipolar disorder until age 50. I thought I was just as normal as everybody else. I just thought I was bubbly and emotional and spiritual and sad when there were reasons for things to be sad. My kids would come home from school to a mom, and they didn't know which mom they were coming home to. If the one that was going to be on the couch and could barely just get up and get them a snack, and then how was your day, and then go back to the couch, and then they were on their own for the rest of the evening. Or the mom that was going to be like, hey, let's do your homework. Come on, we're going to do these projects.
And a good friend of mine, I think one of her kids is suffering from some depression issues, and one of her kids is on ADHD meds. And I suggested that on the son that was depressed, I'm like, well, maybe get him some medication. And you would have thought that I had offended in ways that you couldn't even imagine, because I had suggested medication. And I went to go see the group, and I've now been the same psychiatrist, oh God, 6-7 years. And they're great. But it was, they had to peel back the layers of what was going on to get to the actual diagnosis.
In spite of my flaws, I've been able to accomplish some pretty amazing things that a lot of people that suffer with this two speeds, zoom and off, never can do.
And I know this from dealing with a lot of survivors, is that how often sexuality, the exploitation of sexuality, comes up to prey on people in vulnerable conditions.
Yeah. Men will prey on you because hypersexuality is a known symptom, a known issue. So you have to be very careful with that. You've got to protect yourself from that at all costs. And my therapist said, and this is a secular therapist, not a Christian therapist, and she said, let me ask you something. Are you going to destroy your life, destroy your family, ruin your relationship with your kids and your husband? This is really harsh. Over a muscle spasm. Are you really going to do this? Over a muscle spasm.
That's awesome. The information shared in this podcast is for entertainment purposes only and should not be considered legal advice or a substitute for professional legal advice. Today's guest is a best-selling author, award-winning singer and songwriter, and interior designer known for creating soulful healing spaces. Liz has been married for 35 years, raised 2 incredible children, and built a life grounded in strong, healthy relationships. Through her work and her story, Liz is building an online platform for sharing her lifestyle with wisdom and experiences to help women who suffer from bipolar disorder find acceptance and hope by providing validation and insights to the sacrifices necessary for their emotional health. Liz desires to give them courage and help them feel secure about their ability to heal and live a joyful and productive life in spite of pain. Liz, thank you so much for being here on the Loveless Law podcast today. I really appreciate you bringing your wealth of knowledge and expertise to our shared audience. So why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
All righty. Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here. I mean, it really is. And talking about these things is my passion, and it's kind of a calling. I mean, basically, I've just had a long creative history. And in spite of my flaws, I've been able to accomplish some pretty amazing things that a lot of people that suffer with this two speeds, zoom and off, never can do. And I never realized I had a story to share. I really didn't until, you know, I read a similar story in an anthology, and then I felt this like God just saying, you have a story. And I was like, no, I don't. I'm not going to tell that story. But I just felt more and more this urge to this sort of like a spiritual urge to start sharing my story about suffering from bipolar disorder. So that's kind of where I am. But I do have a history. When I graduated from Baylor, I got a job with EDS, and I developed the first scheduling system for trading megawatts of power at the inception of the industry, and it sold for millions of dollars. I mean,
wow.
Like, yeah, that was my first big adult thing. And then I quit, and I had kids, and I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. And so when I was a stay-at-home mom, I did like my own floral design business out of the house. I started writing music. I started doing little mini design consults. And then I got into, you know, actually being more serious about singing and songwriting, but I couldn't pay for the production costs. I was writing some really good stuff, but I couldn't pay for, so I got certified to teach voice. So I taught voice for several years, and then God moved us to Prague, Czech Republic, for 3 years, and I started playing there. I met a guy. I ended up getting connected through some interesting ways to one of the top two guitarists in the Czech Republic, and I didn't know this about him. And he started working with me on my music, and he said it was really good. You need to play. And I was like, I'm scared. So I got my keyboard and I went out on the street outside of our building. We lived, like I was telling you earlier, an old building, tourist, you know, thoroughfare. There's a lot of people walking by. And I just went on the street and just started playing with my keyboard and microphone and pretended like nobody was listening so I could get used to people walking around and just ignoring me. Well, after a while, I got better and the little crowd started to form. And so then I wouldn't take money because we were in Eastern Europe, right? And I'm an American. So they were bringing me like flowers and perfume and stuff. And then the local restaurants were like, oh, she can bring people in here. So they started paying me to come in and play.
Well, that's not bad.
It was great. And so I just kind of went from there and there and got in some larger venues. And I ended up having an award-winning title called King of Steady. And I had a trending title called That's the Way. And then I had the number one position on the Refurb Nation charts as a singer-songwriter in Czech Republic.
When you graduated from Baylor, that wasn't even on your bingo card. No.
Well, I grew up as a... I mean, my first childhood memory is my mother bouncing me on her knee at the piano singing the Surrey song from Oklahoma. So I took piano all my life. I sang in church from 7 years old on. So music was always in my blood, but you know, my parents said, well, you're not going to make money and you need a business degree. You need blah, blah, blah. I would not do well in a job working for an employer holding down. I could not, I'm telling you, I could not be in a job from 9 to 5. Nobody wants me to work for them.
I always say, like, I don't do well with bosses.
Yeah, you've passed this interview. We'll hire you. We just don't know quite what for yet, but we would hire you. Right. All right, Michelle?
That's good to know.
Or Michelle would. I just sit there and... No.
So that's
You can't major in dance. You can't major in ballet. You can't major in cheerleading. You can't major in singing. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably the same advice we give our kids now.
It is.
But tell me, because I'm curious, because part of your platform revolves around bipolar disorder.
Oh, 100%. Right. Basically, it's hard to develop healthy relationships when you have bipolar. The number one thing that has kept me in recovery, and I think it is by far the number one thing that kept me from being a train wreck while dealing with this, unmedicated, raising my kids with a husband that traveled all the time and didn't understand it. And even not having a lot of friends, because you don't have a filter when you're not. I mean, you say stuff that offends people all the time. So it took me a long time.
The filter's gone when you're not medicated, gone.
And I was like, what did I say? Like, I just wanted friends. It was my relationship with Jesus. It was my faith in God. And I'm very blessed that I was raised in a Christian home. It was not a perfect home at all. Like, there was some very serious problems in my home of origin, but the faith was present and I was taught that faith. And as a young adult, I went way away from it. I came back to it. I did all the other religions. I went through all of that and I came back to that. And that was an anchor. And part of the reason that worked for me is because many people who suffer from bipolar disorder are deeply spiritual. So we feel like if you have a relationship with the Lord, in my case, you actually feel his spirit. You actually feel his presence. You actually hear him speak to you in your heart or in your mind. And so you don't feel as alone, even though the loneliness is excruciating, like beyond reality when you suffer from this. So that's the number one thing in answer to your question. But since I found out what I have and how to manage it, the lifestyle is basically, and these things are hard. Just living a normal life is really hard for a person who has bipolar. 3 meals a day. It has
really?
Taken me.
I mean, something as simple as 3 meals a day.
Yes. I still have to make sure I eat lunch. I have to make myself stop and eat lunch. I have to set a timer because I could just go, 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 go.
Right.
Like, what's the guy? Robert Downey Jr. in Sherlock.
Yeah.
You know, in those movies where he's in the studio he has and he's doing all these ambitions and he's hyped up on camera. I mean, that guy's not eating, you know? I mean, that's the best. I love that movie because he's so bipolar in that movie. I love it. You know, 3 meals a day and you got to have protein. You have to keep your blood sugar stable because if your blood sugar drops, it actually triggers depression.
Really?
Yes.
Small lifestyle changes. I mean, yes, medication helps, but there are other, I mean, I wouldn't say simple, but just logical, eat and eat protein and eat well-balanced and don't let your sugar crash. I mean, that applies for people to get hangry too, but that's different than bipolar.
The thing is, people who get hangry, they're hangry because they're used to eating lunch and they didn't get to do it till later.
Right.
They're not hangry because they didn't eat lunch or didn't eat for hours and didn't even think about it till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That was me. And sleeping. Getting a good night's sleep is virtually impossible when you're manic. Virtually impossible. And and when you're depressed, it is hell to make yourself get up at 7. My husband, you need to go to bed, you know, 10 p.m., get up at 7. Basically, go to bed at the same time every night, get up at the same time every morning.
Wait, not 2 a.m., Jake? Not because that's the...
You know, it's discipline, Michelle. If you go to bed every day at 2 a.m., then you're fine, right? But if you stay up and sort of go 4 a.m. or 12 p.m., it's not going to work, okay?
So, Liz, sleep is an issue. You get to a certain age as a woman, like sleep becomes an enemy, not your friend. That's the best way to put it, even though you still need the sleep. And so because Jake and I are two different time zones, I will wake up at 2 a.m., because that's like it's like 3 a.m. is like the witching hour for me. And I text him, he's still awake. So I'm like, I don't know how I couldn't do it. I have to be in bed by 10.
And here's the one thing, Liz, I do want to mention is that you've gone through dealing with this and you were obviously diagnosed later in life. But when other people in your life that you're responsible for, like your children, and then forming a supportive relationship with your husband, I would love to know more about the toll that takes on what you just mentioned in terms of discipline, having to do certain things, because discipline doesn't basically have a place sometimes, your own personal discipline, when you're dealing with other people and you're there expected to care for them.
When you're not medicated and you have bipolar, you drop the ball. I mean, you drop the ball. The kids didn't always have a snack in the fridge waiting for them when they came home. One thing I did really consistently was make dinner every night. It was just my mother made dinner every night and I made dinner every night. And we always had dinner as a family. It was just, you know, maybe I slept till 5 in the evening, but I still got up and I made dinner and I had enough ingredients to make dinner out of something. And I was pretty creative so I could pull it together. But there were mornings, even when the kids were like 10 and 11, they got up and they got themselves ready for school and made their own breakfast because I couldn't get up. I was that depressed. And Dan was traveling or he was gone. So it wasn't perfect. I would forget to feed the dog for 3 days and not realize it until he was like stalking me
like,
every
where's
time.
Where's my food?
Now, and as far as the spectrum of bipolar, if one is, you know, cyclothymia, kind of just maybe ups and downs, 10-20% more than the average person, and 10 is in a psych ward, I'm a 5. So out of 5, those are the kinds of things that would happen. And it would either be like that, where the house, I'd be too, it was really kind of interesting because if I was depressed, the house wouldn't get clean, the laundry wouldn't get done, the grocery shopping was there, but it was half-ass. And when I was manic, I was too busy saving the world or becoming a rock star to do all that mundane stuff. So my family will all divorce me if I get off my medication. I am a history. Two things. My kids always knew I loved them. They knew I adored them. I may have dropped the ball and things may have slipped through the cracks, but I still instilled good values in them. And I still poured good things. They knew I loved them. I just dropped the ball sometimes and the family just kind of learned to pick it up whenever I dropped it. So they never doubted that. And I think if Gabrielle hears this, she'll say, Mom, you weren't nearly as bad as you made yourself out to be. But there were things that when they grew up and I began to become aware of the implications of my condition in their childhood lives, I sat down with her. I think I sat down with Wesley too, and I had a list of things that I apologized to her for as dropping the ball as a mom.
Wow.
Because I didn't mean to do it, but just because I didn't mean to do it doesn't mean it didn't hurt her.
Right.
And we cried and we went through that list. And she said, Mom, I wouldn't want anyone else to be my mom. It was a beautiful time of healing. So you can, even if you, okay, my girlfriend, her mother was bipolar. She's my closest friend. Her mother, for the last 7 years of her life, was homeless. And they found her dead at 74. In a lean-to. At any time, her mother would have come to her and taken her medicine. She would have taken her in. Right. She would have been ready to be healed. You know, I just feel so sad. That was a case where she just wouldn't take her medicine. And no matter how much money her family offered her or shelter, they said, if you're going to come, you've got to take your medicine. Nope. She'd rather be homeless than...
And that part of that is the mental health condition. I mean, and part of that is because they're not medicated and they can't see clearly to understand that what they're doing is, I hate using the word normal because I don't believe there's such a thing as a normal. And I think there's norm standards, but everyone's an individual. That being said, the mental health condition prohibits her or prohibited her from seeing that what she was doing was not appropriate. I mean, it's mental health is really a thing. And we are, I think, as a society, so far behind the ball on actually treating mental health conditions, but I think we're trying to get better. But the other problem is it's so expensive to get mental health treatment. Like, how many therapists don't take insurance?
I know. Mine doesn't. But
mine doesn't.
He's reasonable. Yeah. And the really good ones typically don't.
When you had first exhibited signs of bipolar disorder in your childhood, your mother basically had said, you have two speeds, right? When you started getting out there and started sort of realizing that, let's say you were different or that your patterns of behavior were different, how did that ultimately impact who you let into your life? And especially when dating someone, did you make special concessions, say, well, this person's going to have to get used to this? Or did you try to shield a lot of that stuff and just hope it would work itself out?
I had no idea. I thought I was just as normal as everybody else. I just thought I was bubbly and emotional and spiritual and sad when there were reasons for things to be sad. Like it didn't occur to me until maybe my 30s. And then, I mean, I don't know how many decades ago was it that, you know, I think in the 50s, women took Valium for depression, but.
Oh, they did. Valium was a big deal.
Michelle, like, you know, like you were around then.
No,
the way she said that. Oh, yeah. We were on it all the time, you know, going to our bridge games.
It was like your 5 o'clock pill was my understanding what Valium was like back in the day. And the only time I've ever had Valium is when I had my LASIK surgery. So Jake, you ever get the courage to do LASIK? We've talked about this. So they gave you Valium. And what was it? They called it, didn't they call it Mother's Helper?
I think so.
Isn't that what it was called back then? It was called Mother's Helper.
I think so.
There was a marketing branding campaign to kind of, you know, curb the pharmaceutical nature of it. Yes.
Right. All right. Yeah. So, sorry, I went on a Valium squirrel. Sorry.
That's okay.
Please, that speaks to what the theme is here. Back then, there's a lot of things they didn't know about. And even what you were dealing with, Liz, is very interesting because you were kind of on your own for many years. You really didn't know. And it was really how people react to you if they want to stay in your life or leave your life was kind of your measurement, right?
It was horrible. I had, you know, no confidence. I was very lonely and I thought it was all my fault. I thought there was something wrong with me in the way that nobody wants to hang out with me. But it wasn't like I knew I had an illness. I did not know. I knew I had some depression. I thought maybe I had depression because of family of origin issues. I talk about this in my book. I don't know if I mentioned in the beginning, there's a book called Embracing Wisdom on the Walk. You can get it on Amazon. I condensed a 25-year history of this journey to diagnosis into 3,000 words because that was all I had for one chapter in that book. But in that book, I talk about that being raised in a religious background and going to Christian counselors and things, and you're bemoaning, you're not happy. And they always say, well, that's because something is wrong with your relationship with Jesus. Jesus is supposed to meet all your needs. And, you know, there's kind of an anti-medicine, you know, Jesus is your healer. And so I worked and worked and worked and worked on my relationship with Jesus. I spent hours in the Bible. I prayed. I wrote worship songs. You know, I did everything I could. But I was still miserable. I was depressed. I was lonely. So I healed all my family of origin issues. And I was still depressed and still lonely. And so then I finally started seeing psychiatrists. The first time I saw a psychiatrist, I was in my 40s. Did I finally see a psychiatrist? And otherwise, it was just like I always had some therapist. I just like always had some therapist. And you know, and just was pouring out my heart, and oversharing to the world. So when I found out I was suffering from bipolar disorder, and that's what it was all along, it made sense to everyone who knew me, like people that knew me.
The duh factor. It's like, oh, that makes so much sense.
That's been the missing link.
Here's my question, Liz, because you've been married for 35 years, okay? Mm-hmm. And you've been married for 35 years with a pretty serious mental health condition. So one, congratulations on being married for 35 years. As a divorce attorney, I love seeing like long-term marriages. I was married for 22 and now not married. But making marriage work is difficult, period. You add in a mental health disorder, it makes it much more challenging. So what tips do you have? Because you've done it. You've had the successful marriage despite mental health issues. So what's your secret sauce?
I actually wrote some things down for this because I knew it would come up, of course.
Liz, I want to ask you, do you prefer what's the politically correct term? Is it mental health disorder, mental health condition, mental health? Like, is there
a mental mood disorder? It's called a mental mood disorder. And Michelle, a minute ago, you said, you know, there's no such thing as normal. It's the term I use is neurotypical. There's a spectrum of neurotypical. And when you fall outside of that spectrum, they call it a disorder. And to be honest, there is another neurodivergence. Okay, that's another term. It's a little less derogatory than saying you have a disorder. But at the same time, saying you have a disorder is helpful because it aligns it with a physical, you know, I suffer from pneumonia. And even today when my therapist says, well, it's like having pneumonia, it's the same. I'm like, really?
No,
like,
it's not.
You forget it. Well, no, but it is in the sense that it's just as serious. It's actually a condition that needs to be treated. It's easy for someone to have, you know, understand you're diabetic, you need to stop, you need to give yourself shots, you need to do certain things. But when they meet someone who's bipolar, people have no clue what it takes to manage your life.
They do not.
And it's really important not to overshare. But as far as staying in marriage, the first thing you have to do is you have to pick wisely. And I think
that's what we need to figure out, the secret sauce to picking wisely.
Well, I think my upbringing had a lot to do with that. My faith had a lot to do with that. And I think the fact that we're an opposites attract couple.
You're yin and yang. Right?
I'm emotional. I'm passionate. I'm dramatic. I'm Indiana's facts and figures, data-driven, logical, calm, introverted, gentle. And he just, the song I wrote called King of Steady that won an award in the International Songwriters Competition is about him. He's my King of Steady and I'm the Queen. So that doesn't mean it's been easy. It's been very hard. Okay. It's really, no matter what, it's very hard. And, you know, for many years he was traveling and it was all on me. And then when he came home, we were just a family, all of us together. So there was a bit of tension broken between us because it was all about the kids. But later, as they got busier and older and started driving, that's when I think we started having more difficulties. And I had a midlife crisis and I almost left him and I almost just lost touch with reality and went off the deep end. And by then he'd kind of shut down because he had this wife he really didn't know what to do with. And when you're suffering from it, you really don't know how hard you are to live with. You think you're wonderful. Yeah. You're like, I'm great. You know,
I'm great. I'm not a problem. You're the problem.
You're the one. You're the one. So, but only 10% of marriages where one party suffers from bipolar disorder last. And
wow, that's a huge statistic.
Yeah. So it's really, really hard. But I think we align in our values. You know, divorce has always kind of not been an option. There are times that I have wanted to make it. There are times we've both almost walked away more than once each, I would say. It's been an incredible challenge, but we've made it because we have too much to lose. And we do, at the heart of things, we do love each other. And what's been beautiful is even recently, with some very recent episodes, he has come alongside me in a way. I mean, look, a bad marriage will kill you, even if you're normal.
So when
I say it's just about killed us, I'm not kidding. But if you can push through that, if you can just get to the other side of those really, really hard moments, there is gold. There is the next level you can get to. And it's hard. I would say for us, about every 10 years, it's been like the 10-year mark has been where some big things happen. And then we fix it. But it's not like we just fix it like fixing a broken toy. I mean, we definitely do counseling. We're both, you know, it took him a long, long time, but after the 20th year and the 24th year, when I was really falling apart, he finally really joined the counseling full on. And so we're pretty regular with that. We kind of have to be. I have to be. And so he just jumps in every couple sessions, that kind of thing.
Did he take it upon himself to learn more about bipolar disorder?
He did. And I think he thought he'd kind of learned enough. And I think he thought that I was managing it just fine on my own. But then he realized that, no, he needs to learn more because I'm suffering and I need support. I need more support for the marriage to continue to work. And it's on me to be accountable and to do my part. But it's also on him to help me when I just can't, you know. So he'll do things like, you know, the thing about going to bed at the same time and getting up in the morning at the same time, he will come in. And no matter how mean and nasty I am about getting up, he will get me out of bed.
Oh, wow.
And that's love. You know, that's love. He makes me a cup of tea now in the morning. And it means the world to me because it means he accepts me the way I am. He's not using my mental health as an excuse or dismissing my feelings. The other thing I have now, we have a calendar on the wall. And I put a number on the scale of 1 to 10. Of how depressed or manic. So he kind of knows. And then we have a pattern. So we both kind of know what's coming. Okay. We've had a few days of 7
good, right.
level, which means like mania. Okay. Now we know in a few days, I'm probably going to be at a 3, you know? And also, this is what I learned yesterday. I was getting so pissed at my counselor because I'm expressing myself to him. And he's like, well, you know, You know, that's, you know, that's your, you need to look at this from the perspective of the self-awareness that you're in a manic episode. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm just pissed, you know, or I'm just irritated. Why is it always a manic episode? Why is it always a depressive episode? Why can't you just take my feelings verbatim, like at face value? And I said, is it true that when you have this disorder, that always what you're feeling, what you're expressing is going to always be colored by your condition? And he said, yes. And it blew me away because I was always under the impression or belief that there are times I'm just normal and I'm just in between. And what I'm thinking and feeling is like, I can't see it. So now when I put a 3 on the calendar and I express myself to Dan, for example, in the marriage, we can both know I'm a 3. So then he has a gauge on, okay, she is upset about something or she is down about something. And sometimes you're just down for no reason because it's just a dysregulation of neurotransmitter. But if there is something you're expressing that you're down about, let's say you're actually expressing something you're really down about. It's not just your dysregulation. Your dysregulation is just exacerbating it. Well, if I'm a 3 that day, he can go, okay, she's troubled over this, but it's about a couple degrees lower than what the real level of the situation actually
is. So you're like probably a 1, even though you're saying you're a 3.
Okay, so let's say you have a problem, mm-hmm. and it's affecting you like it would. You had a disappointment at work. Okay, a level 5 would be what you or Jake would, you know, go, okay, so I had a disappointment at work, but it's going to be okay. Well, if you're a level 3 emotionally that day and you're bipolar, that disappointment is going to affect you a lot more dramatically.
Right.
You're going to be like, oh no, you know.
The world's coming to an end.
Yeah. Well, if you're a 1, you're like going to commit suicide over it, right? Okay. If you're a 2, you're going to go to bed over it. If you're a 3, you're going to, you know, just really struggle. And a 4, you're just going to be more dramatic than what the situation, you know, requires or demands. And so now he can go, okay, this is the actual situation. This is something to be frustrated over, but she's a couple degrees too frustrated over it.
Okay.
You know, because she's a 3 today.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
So it helps him not invalidate my feelings, but it helps him bring me back to like a level that I
to neutral
should be.
Yeah,
and if I'm willing to be self-aware, that's the other thing. You almost can't be self-aware enough, but you do have to be willing to try to see it or hear it. And that it's hard. It's really hard.
You were kind of on your own for many years. You really didn't know. And it was really how people react to you if they want to stay in your life or leave your life was kind of your measurement, right? A lot of times in families or friends or whatnot, society, there's a stigma about mental health. And it's actually gotten a lot better. I mean, back in the old days, there was no Talkspace or BetterHelp, or there was
none
really addressing this stuff. And I think that what happens is that when people say, my child or my significant other needs to get support for their mental health issues, they see it as a flaw. They see it as a liability. The one way that I've seen to really understand it is have that person research the condition first. Understand what this person is dealing with. Understand that there are many things chemically that no amount of therapy can cure from that standpoint. And then look at what kind of deficit chemically there is potentially in this way. And then from there, understand what the medication does. It's not a flaw. What it is that not everybody has an equal baseline is the problem.
Correct.
Okay. And so you look at these kind of situations, and I think that part of it is self-education. You know what I'm saying? It's not a flaw. It's not a deficit. It's just the human condition. And not the same way some people you know, have physical ailments. Other people have medical ailments that need to be addressed. And we're fortunate that we have medication that can do this. I mean, 100 years ago, people were locked up.
Van Gogh killed himself, you know.
Like, there was no treatment for schizophrenia back then, right? Like, there just wasn't. You did. Jake, you're exactly right. They locked him up in an institution and threw away the key and left him. I mean,
parents couldn't deal with kids like that. They were put in like places like even Bellevue. This is not even maybe 50 or 60 years ago. They were doing this. Like there was no way to deal with somebody who was under these sort of circumstances or these conditions. And I think that that's the one thing is that it's hard to get people who are very stubborn when it comes to their own biases, when it comes to mental health support. But it really does start with education. Understand the condition. Then start there, and then you can see what the treatment plan consists of. When someone is diagnosed with a mental health condition, how often people will manipulate that and use that in any sort of divorce proceeding? Because what you just said, Liz, is very poignant and very strong position, because it's basically like saying, well, anything that you look through this view with, there's the potential, or not even potential, there is the absolute certainty that your condition will impact whatever emotion you're feeling that can't be disciplined, that can't be regulated. So, Michelle, I would love to hear from you how situations like Liz, if Liz had been going through something like this with a significant other, how that comes up in court and how the manipulation of someone's condition affects their case.
Boy, to say that it gets weaponized would be an understatement. What I do see, though, which I really do appreciate, at least in where I practice in Texas, is the courts are pretty very cognizant of misuse of mental health information and how that can affect someone's life long term, right? Like, if you may not want your employer to know that you've got bipolar disorder, and that's why we've got strict HIPAA rules and confidentiality rules about how you can share information. And I see it in custody battles in particular, where it's, she has anxiety, or she is bipolar, or she has whatever the condition is, so she shouldn't have the child. Or she takes medication, like if you take a benzodiazepine, and she takes a benzodiazepine, so she shouldn't have kids, or shouldn't have the kids full time. Dad should have them. What you also see is it weaponized, because the one spouse will trigger an episode and then record it. Right. Mm. Because they know the buttons to push. If you were with someone, you know their buttons. Oh, yeah. You know what their triggers are. And if you want to manipulate the situation for creating evidence in court, you can absolutely click. It's like they always talk about the red button for launching the missiles. They do. It's mental health. You know, if you know what your spouse has or doesn't have, and you know which red button to push to get the. And then you record it.
So
then
mean.
You record it, and that gets played in court. I mean, I've had ones in court where, they're terrible explosions, and they're things that is not normal for that person, but because they got triggered and got recorded. And so, it happens more often than it should in litigation, where your mental health is absolutely weaponized. And I've used the comparison to, if you have cancer, you don't lose your child because you have a medical condition, right? You don't lose your kid because you've got cancer. But people use mental health conditions as reasons to take away your kids. And so that's why I'm a big fan of, if you have a mental health condition, that just stay treated. All the courts generally would like to see is that you're stable, you're med compliant, and you're doing what you're supposed to do to protect your mental health. And so long as you're doing those things, it shouldn't affect your custody. But let me tell you what, the people that you are with, you're divorcing, they're not your friend, they're not your buddy anymore. They are only looking out for themselves. And so they will absolutely weaponize it.
It's sad. I mean, there are times that people use it as an excuse. Mm-hmm. You're wrong. They want to be right. So they'll just say, well, you're bipolar. So
you're crazy.
Mm-hmm. You're crazy. You have a diagnosis on paper.
Exactly. So. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to take the kids away from you because you've got bipolar. The threats that occur. And then what you see and what I see.
It's devastating.
Is the text messages. Because when you are in episodes, and Liz, you probably know this, your text messages change. And so if you're manic, you'll send like 4 pages at once of text messages, which makes you look, in layman's terms, crazy. It just does. If you don't have a single response, but you have got 4 pages of messages that you've sent with no response. Or when you're in the down phase, you send messages like saying, I want to kill myself, or I don't want to go on anymore. And you use all of these things. And then, or you say all these things, that because you're in a low, and those are exhibit A's in court. Well, judge, she's threatened suicide 5 different times.
Liz, you're an artist. You're a mother. You're a wife. You're so many things, so many multi-hyphenates. How do you not let your condition become the primary focus of a conversation, especially when you go public? How do you balance that?
Well, first of all, that's a really good question. So I only started kind of putting out the story in 2024.
Oh, wow. So, okay. You started then about the same time I did.
Oh, cool.
I started the end of 2023. 2024 is when this whole journey for me started. It was the same thing. I mean, in fact, Jake was the first show I ever appeared on in March of 2024 on Strictly Stalking. But that's how I got my start.
It was a true honor. Is that how I should have said it, Michelle, or a little bit? It was a true honor to have Michelle Locke as a first guest on our show. Is that good?
That's good. I mean, you're lying through your teeth, but
no,
I am.
I'll work that later. Sorry, I'll do AI later. You can AI it later.
What was it that made you, because I know it did it for me, but what was it that made you say, you know what, I'm going to talk about this?
It was God. I didn't want to. I was embarrassed. I was kind of mortified, actually. And I was afraid. I was very afraid. But it helps. There's a few things you have to be very, very careful with. I don't mind speaking on a podcast or doing some TikTok videos because, you know, I didn't realize what I had to bring to the world. I didn't realize how I could be used to show people who suffer from this condition that they do have the ability to push the world forward with their gifts and talents, that they do have value. They're not a lost cause, and they don't have to be a train wreck or stay a train wreck. If I can do this, you can do this. Then it suddenly became a passion. It became a passion for me. And I fell in love just with all the women I don't even know yet who have this. I see them lonely in their homes. I see them struggling in their relationships. I see them in my mind's eye. And I just want to, if I had had someone like me to talk to in those years. So I really do, you know, I want to write a book. I mean, there's a lot more I'd like to do with it. I've got visions for my social media platform. But this is the thing. I feel okay talking about it like this, because I have a lot of degrees of separation between me and who's listening.
Right.
And I also feel under the covering and protection of my husband. I think as a woman in particular with this condition, you have to be very careful not to overshare it.
Yeah.
For 2 reasons. Men will prey on you because hypersexuality is a known symptom, a known issue. So you have to be very careful with that. You've got to protect yourself from that at all costs, because that is the fastest way for you to become a train wreck in your life, is for you to be sleeping around.
Yeah.
And it's hard, but you can do it. And I have a whole list of stuff just about that.
And I know this from dealing with a lot of survivors, is that how often sexuality, the exploitation of sexuality, comes up to prey on people in vulnerable conditions. Yeah. If you have that list, that would be great to sort of dive in to understand how to navigate through these things. Because if you're dealing with this condition, these are real things. Same way with eating 3 square meals. What do you need to avoid when it comes to sex and encounters?
There's a number of things, boundaries. Okay. The first thing I think I was raised as an Egyptian American. So, you know, Middle Eastern women are very protected in that way. And my father taught me how a guy is supposed to treat me and how he's not. And he taught me the value of my body. He was an OB-GYN, as a matter of fact. So he had a very unique perspective on that as well. You know, he saw all kinds of stuff, and he didn't want his daughters to fall into some of the pitfalls he saw his patients. So the value of what I'm worth was deeply instilled in me by my dad. And when that's instilled in you by a male figure in your life, that that stays with you. So I can just say you have to have a solid moral foundation or you're not going to make it, period. You have to have immovable boundaries. And my immovable boundaries are within my marriage only. But sometimes, even if you have the foundation and the immovable boundary, and even if you have a spouse that loves you and that is doing everything to make you feel protected, you have to have a spouse that you're attracted to, first of all. That's very important. Yeah. And that loves you, supports you, and makes you feel loved in a way you actually feel it. Not just like, well, I do love you. Like, do I have to keep telling you that? Don't you know that? It can't be like that. Like, they actually have to. Oh my gosh, I have to tell you what I just learned. It was like, it just was mind boggling. And I only learned this, two things. I only learned yesterday.
Yesterday.
Yesterday. I was sitting in a therapy session and I was struggling. I was in the music world. I was hobnobbing with musicians all the time. It was kind of the first time in 20 years I'd not been a mom. I was out in public and I didn't really know I was beautiful and attractive and all those things. So I was finding out that I actually was a desirable woman. And so I was tempted left and right. It was really, really hard. And my therapist said, and this is a secular therapist, not a Christian therapist. And she said, let me ask you something. Are you going to destroy your life, destroy your family, ruin your relationship with your kids and your husband? This is really harsh, over a muscle spasm. Are you really going to do this?
Are you over really a muscle spasm?
Over a muscle spasm.
That's awesome. That I love it because so direct and blunt. I love that.
It's succinct and has a practicality like I've never imagined before.
I'm going to use that. It's a muscle spasm.
You should get a bumper sticker.
It's a muscle spasm. Don't fall for the muscle spasm.
Don't ruin your life over the muscle spasm. Mm. Don't become a train wreck over the muscle spasm.
Oh, I love that. Because I can see a bumper sticker with says muscle spasm with like the big circle and the X through it. Well, that's a great way.
It's brilliant. I mean, but it really boils things down to that condition is like, how much are you willing to risk? And Liz, you know this, is that you've said this before. Your family has been through a lot, okay? Mm. The problem is this, and we had a conversation about this, about infidelity on...
Oh, we did a couple episodes ago, yeah.
Yeah, we did. And it's about when you're in a different situation. You just said this. You're getting that new glance, that new look. You're actually feeling appreciated in a way you haven't felt that way in a long time. It's intoxicating.
It can happen to any woman. Any woman.
Especially if you have that female, like your mom. And you're a mom, and you're a mom, and you're a mom, and then you're a wife, and you're doing those things. And then you step out, and you're not the mom. It's a different role. And I'm now only experiencing this side of it now, where it's, oh, wait, maybe men do like me. And I'm like, and it's a whole new world for me. Whole new world.
No, it really is.
Your human is a shell. It's hilarious.
A muscle spasm isn't worth it. I so love that. I do.
It's the first time I said that in public. I want you to know.
This is the first time I've said that in public.
So I'm glad it's going over well. That's good to know.
That should be a title of one of your chapters. It's only a muscle spasm.
Oh, I will. Ooh, I love that. Yeah. I will have a whole chapter on that. Uh-huh. But there's a few other things that we do. Like I keep Deanna aware of my whereabouts. He's got my location. He knows where I am. I check in with him here and there because I do go and blow a lot, right? And so I check in with him here and there. I bring him on to projects sometimes. I let him meet the contractors I'm working with, things like that. But the most important thing for someone who's suffering from bipolar disorder that I want to say is, and this was hard for me, especially with my religious background, do not feel shame over it. It is part of your condition. Do not feel shame over that. When I was told that and I healed from that, it set me free and it It really did. And I, to this day, I praise God for a wonderful psychologist who has two doctorates and specializes in working with people who suffer from bipolar and co-occurring, and as a believer, as a Christian. When he said that to me, it was like the weight of the world. And I also want to say that to any woman who has slept with 25 men because of their condition, it's never too late to get a new perspective. It's never too late to learn to develop healthy and loving relationships. And it's very, very important that no matter what, you are worth having healthy, loving relationships. You do deserve them as much as any other human does. And you can, it can happen. Yes, you got to make a lot of sacrifices. Yes, you got to work hard. Yes, you got to identify what your values are going to be and what they're not, what your boundaries are going to be. And sometimes you got to just like live through some excruciating moments. But when I've had those excruciating moments, because I have a relationship with God, the Holy Spirit, it always almost like shocks me. Those are some of my most deeply spiritual, comforting, accepting, approving moments in the Spirit when I'm having those excruciating moments around that particular thing, sitting in my car or wherever I am. And I'm like, wow, you love me in spite of this. Like you actually have compassion on me and mercy on me for these temptations I'm experiencing. And it's okay in your eyes. And you get me through. And now I know because you're in touch with it. You love me. I know you're going to protect me. And I'm going to be able to stay on the straight and narrow.
Thank you for joining us. Your insight and self-awareness is something that, one, is to be admired. And sharing your story, I know, will help others, because I do agree with you that shame should be removed from the vernacular. Like, there's no shame. And you can always choose a different path than what you have done before. And everyone is worthy of love and respect, no matter what your past is. I mean, you can always start today choosing to be someone else. And you can start today getting the help you need for mental health if you need it. Where can our audience find you?
At Liz Gabriel Lifestyle. And it's, I'm still getting used to TikTok, but at Liz Gabriel Lifestyle, I think, is the handle on TikTok. And then it just says Bipolar Mentor. I've got Liz Gabriel Interiors on Instagram. That's my interior design handle. And it's gorgeous. You need to go look at it. It's just awesome. And I have Liz Z Tells Stories on Instagram. And it is actually the handle, but the name is Liz Gabriel Lifestyle. I'm just beginning to get the courage to share my mental health lifestyle in public. It's been hard to reconcile that with being a business owner and clients perhaps shying away from me as a potential designer to hire because they may find me. So I don't have my handle on Instagram as Liz Gabriel Lifestyle. That's evolving. I'm on LinkedIn, Liz Gabriel Interiors. Liz Gabriel on any music streaming platform. You can hear the music. And that's it.
Well,
it's been a pleasure.
It really has been. I look forward to talking more. Thank you for joining me on today's episode of Love Less Law. If you want to reach out or find out more about what's going on with me, you can follow me across social media platforms at Attorney Michelle Locke. You can also send me an email at hello@michellelocke.com. Just remember, in addition to it being just a muscle spasm, Michelle is spelled with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, with no T for that. Have a great one.